Good morning, everyone. How is everybody? Are we good? Is anyone tired? Yeah, that's like when usually when people ask me, "How are you, Rob?" That's the response. Good, but tired. Well, good, but busy and tired. Well, tired is kind of the common denominator of like how, I don't know, or just the modern condition maybe. Do you know what I mean? Seems the world is set up in some ways to make you feel tired. It feels like unavoidable. It feels like inevitable. It feels like just the space that we live in, the expectations maybe we place on our own lives or are not placed on us, leave us just feeling wrecked. Yeah, the economy, the pressures, the cost of living, the long commutes, the busyness, the expectations from work, the culture, the environment, the always on culture of like of work pushing boundaries, you know what I mean? Always like expecting more from you, pushing more from you, just leaves you wrecked. Even with enough sleep, right? Even if like sometimes we think, well, just get on top of it, just get more sleep, get your nutrition right, start exercising, all those practical things we can do, right? But the net results, I don't know if it's the same for you, but for me in general, is that still we end up tired, just end up wrecked, and maybe that's why as we've been reading, we read from the Bible Project, we read a chapter of the New Testament, chapter of the Old Testament today. We've just been working our way through Exodus. And maybe it's because of that background noise of tiredness in my own life that stuff really jumped out to me. This thing of work and of rest and of just feeling wrecked. I just saw it in every page as I turned. And I wanna spend a bit of time this morning in that, in the book of Exodus. We call this message like Sabbath rest. Finding freedom in a world of overwork, right? And I use that word freedom intentionally. Not just finding balance or finding rest or finding a space to recuperate or finding like practicalities for how to deal with work or whatever. I really think the Bible frames it in terms of like slavery and freedom, which are big terms. Do you know what I mean? Who wants to be a slave to anything? Nobody. Who wants to be free? Everybody, yeah? And this message, this story we have in Exodus, I think we'll see some parallels as to how we actually find freedom. Because as I read Exodus, I see this is what I became convinced of, that overwork, right? Overwork, now whether it's practical, like physical work, or just the work under our work, just the environment we live in where we never switch off, where there's always a striving or something, right? That this mode of living is a tactic of the enemy to oppress and to enslave people. And to cause them to be numb or unreceptive, unresponsive to the things of God, to the work of God. And we see God's response to this oppression in something called Sabbath, right? So two things I want to do this morning. One, that we begin to see how our work might be enslaving us. Maybe that's a new idea to you. But hopefully to see how that can be and probably is the case in some way, shape or form. And second, that we recognize that the root out of that slavery into freedom is via this thing called Sabbath that only Jesus really, really offers. Yeah? So we're gonna move through Exodus, right? Looking at hitting at different points. You can turn in your Bibles or we'll have some of the stuff up on the screen there. To set the scene, don't want to make any assumption that anyone knows the story, but Exodus tells the story of an Exodus, yeah? Of like this mass movement of people who were slaves in Egypt, out of Egypt into freedom. It tells that whole story. What had happened is the people of Israel, the story of Joseph, they'd ended up in Egypt when Joseph was in command there, was a ruler there. And it says like at the end of Genesis or beginning of Exodus, about 70 of them moved into Egypt. Fast forward like 400 years, we reckon, and there's a couple of million of them there, right? They've multiplied. And the Egyptians are kind of wary of them because there's so many of them. And they, instead of them being like welcomed people in the land, they become slaves. They start to be oppressed. They're wary that they rise up. You pick up the story there in Exodus 1. And here's what Pharaoh says to his people. So the ruler of Egypt says about the Israelites who multiplied in the land. Look, he says, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many and they're too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. And they built for Pharaoh store cities of Pithom and Ramses." So Pharaoh's strategy, there's too many of these Israelites. There's too many of them. They might overtake us. If enemies come, they might join with them. And then there's real fear, which is like they might leave the land.
isn't like just that they might overtake them, but that they might lose out on having them as a workforce, right? So he wants to control them. So what does? He sets them to afflict them with heavy burdens. He put taskmasters over them, people who are driving them, people who are pushing them, people who are applying pressure. He creates like a cultural environment, a system whereby there's constant pressure on these people to perform, with the aim that they'll be so busy that they won't be able to uprise. They'll be so tired that they won't be able to fight back. They'll be so overworked that they won't have time to think about freedom or join in anything else. Yeah, he oppresses them by giving them work. He continues to make them slaves by giving them work that they can't see past. Make them so busy. And you see that that's a tool of the enemy, because work is meant to be good. You rewind to like Genesis chapter 1 or 2. God makes humanity, it says, makes them in his image. And he gives them this role. He says, like, you go now and go and fill the earth, multiply it, have dominion over it and subdue it. Meaning, like, work is a thing that we're meant to do. We're meant to be co-creators with God. It's meant to be an act of worship. It's meant to be something. It's something that we'll do in eternity. Many people think that the story of Scripture is like that we all end up in some disembodied state floating on clouds, eventually just worshiping the Lord. But no, there's going to be a new heaven and a new earth that's fully redeemed back to its original purpose, where we work on creating, where we work like doing all of the things that maybe we're doing right now, but our motivations are changed. We do them as a reflection of the glory of God, uncovering more of who he is, as an act of worship to God. So work is meant to be good, but by Exodus we see it being used as a tool of oppression, a tool of stopping people becoming what they're meant to be. And then at the end of Exodus 2, Mal, we move on to the next slide, right? It says this, right? So during these many days, the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. Now, these are an oppressed people. This is a group of people living as slaves in a foreign country, and they're groaning and crying out for help. It says this, their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God, and God heard their groan, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. You know, as I read this a few weeks ago when we were in this, just that last verse, God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. It's just like, I don't know, it's fulfilled only a few words, like God saw what and knew what. It's like he saw the oppression of people. He saw what they were going through. He saw the burdens of people. He saw how people were broken. He saw how they were bent down. He saw how they were subdued. He saw, and yeah, what did he know? He knew who he was. He knew what his plans were for them. He knew the promises that he'd made to Abraham, to Isaac, and Jacob. He knew what he was going to do with this nation. And he knew what they were going through. I don't know. It just hit me. It hit me like a ton of bricks to know that. Do you know, church, that you have a God who sees you? And he knows. You might think you're alone. You might think, man, nobody really understands the pressures of work, or the pressures of family, or the pressures of this situation that I'm in, and everything combined to make me feel down, depressed, and oppressed, and to feel like, oh, I don't know, there's nothing I can do to just get through the day. How wrecked I am, how tired I am, how much I've been let down, how this family situation is shaping, how I can't get past it. Like, we can think we're alone in this, but what if you knew it was true that God sees? He sees you this morning, and God knows that he cares. He's going to do something about it. You have a God who sees you. You have a God who knows. You have a God who empathizes. You don't have one distant out there waiting to be pleased. You have one who looks and has compassion, remembers his promises to you, knows who you are, knows where you're at, knows how to get you from where you're at to where he wants you to be. A God who sees you and knows you, sees the struggles, the pressures, the tiredness, the feeling like giving up, the feeling like being trapped, the discouragement. He sees and he knows. That's good news, amen? And then we see, right, chapter 3, this story of Moses begins, right? So we're setting the scene of this oppressed people. And God's response, sometimes we look at Moses, this is a big challenge to me. We look at Moses, we see him as this big figure, like Moses existed just for the sake of Moses to be like some big figure and the plans God had for him. But the whole story of Moses is in response to the people who were oppressed. Like, Moses is just a tool in the hand of God to free his people from it. Like, you know what I mean? Moses isn't the hero of the story. God is the hero of the story. He's like just a hammer in the hand of the Lord, building what he wants to build. It's in response to the brokenness of his people.
God is still responding to the brokenness of people. He's still responding to oppression. He still sees. He sees what you're going through. He sees what our communities are going through. And his response is to have, he has a church who you'd want to mobilize and use as a tool. Anyway, he picks Moses, not because Moses is a good man. Moses is a murderer and a runner liar and just got out of college, escaped. Picks Moses, appears to him, and Bush sends him back into Israel to go to the king of Israel, to go to the Pharaoh, and to say, Yahweh, the God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob, the God of the Israelites, commands you, let my people go. And you might expect that in light of such a strong command, you know the story, you know what happens, but you might expect, if you didn't know the story, that then Pharaoh would be terrified and say, yeah, let them go. But instead, what does Pharaoh do? Chapter 5, you put the next slide up there, Malik. He says this, so Moses has gone to him and said, let my people go. And Pharaoh says this, the king of Egypt said to them, Moses and Aaron, why do you take the people away from their work? Get back to your burdens. And Pharaoh said, behold, the people of this land are now many, and you make them rest from their burdens. The same day Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters of the people and the foremen, you shall no longer give the people straw to make bricks as in the past. Let them go and gather the straw for themselves. But the number of bricks that they made in the past you shall impose on them. You shall by no means reduce it, for they are idle. Therefore they cry, let us go and offer sacrifices to our gods. Let heavier work be laid on them, so that they may labor at it, and pay no regard to lying words. So he does the opposite, right? Instead of letting them go, he keeps on more work. I think there we see a tactic of the world, that there's just this constant pressure towards overwork. And you might seem, right, you might think, well, Pharaoh's shooting himself in the foot here. I don't know, from a perspective of where we feel empowered, where we're not maybe slaves in this, where we feel like, well, if somebody tried to do that to me, we'd uprise, do you know what I mean? We'd take over. You know, like, and there was a fear of, there's like millions of these Israelites, what if they uprise? But he knows that an oppressed people, when you oppress them more, it stops them from, like, it lowers hope. He's like, so he adds on more work. He's not afraid that if I add on more work, when they'll have enough and they'll uprise, he knows that I add on more work and they're going to have time to uprise. They're going to be busy. So they have to still make the same amount of bricks they were before, but now they have to go and get the straw as well. They have taskmasters over them. And even he engages in this kind of psychological manipulation, right? So he just, like, even, what does he do? He calls them lazy. And he says they're idle. Now, the reason you want to go and sacrifice, you don't have enough work to do. You're not busy enough. Maybe you exist in a work situation that would say that or put those same kind of pressures on you. Well, you're just lazy if you're not willing to work Saturdays. You're just lazy if you're not willing to go above and beyond. If you're not, like, just these increasing pressures that look to our identity, like that, they're trying to, like, break us down and say, no, you need to give more, you need to give more. The Israelites were too exhausted to do anything about their situation, and I think the enemy works in similar ways with work in our situations. We end up too exhausted to be able to see even the condition that we're in. Is it possible that our overwork blinds us to other possibilities in the same way? That we're just so busy with the getting up. Like, you might say, well, Robin, it's all right for you to say that. I'm up at 6 a.m. and I get home, I'm off to work, and I come home 12 hours later and I'm just fit for bed, right? I'm back at. Or you might be working on it, but there's still these pressures underneath, right? It's not necessarily just about a work environment. You could be on the dole, you could be retired, but there's still work under the work. There's still pressures, there's still striving going on that makes demands of you, makes demands of your time, and says there's no other way than this. I need to keep staying on the treadmill. I need to keep going. Like, there's no way out of this. That's what overwork does, and it's slavery. It keeps us as slaves. And it blinds us. And the apex of this, right, going to chapter 6, comes at this point. Chapter 6, verse 5. Here's what happens, right? God goes, we preached on this before, actually. Remember, we did a series called The Four Cups. God makes these, like, four promises to Israel, right, here in Exodus chapter 6. And they're huge, right? We'll read what they are now. But this is God, who's revealed himself by name for the first time. Every time you see the Lord there, it's like Yahweh. He's given his name to Moses. And he said, I want to send you to the people, and here's what I want you to tell them. Here's my promises to them. And listen to what he says to this oppressed and enslaved people. He says, I've heard the groaning of the people of Israel,
whom the Egyptians hold as slaves, and I've remembered my covenant. So say therefore to the people of Israel, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I will deliver you from slavery to them, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great acts of judgment, and I will take you to be my people, and I will be your God, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God who has brought you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. And I will bring you into the land that I swore to give to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And I will give it to you for a possession. I am the Lord. He keeps repeating this, I am the Lord. The capital L-O-R-D, like in what's not there in that translation, but wherever it says, I am the Lord, he's saying by name, right? There's revelation. I'm the God who called Abraham. I'm the one who hasn't forgotten you. I'm here. And here's the promises. We call them the four cups. In fact, the Jews still do this thing in the Passover Seder. Passover is eventually how they get out of Egypt. And they remember these four promises of God, right? There's the cup of sanctification saying that I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. The cup of deliverance. They take these cups literally at a meal. Drink this wine. Remember, God promised that he was going to deliver us. Second, God promised that he was going to sanctify us. I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. That God has promised he's going to deliver you. I will deliver you with an outstretched arm. And they have this, the cup of praise that I'll take you to be my people and I will be your God, right? These huge promises that they remember. Now, can you imagine, right, if you're this people, this enslaved people, and Moses comes, having heard from God, performing miracles, his staff is turning into snakes, and it's like all sorts of stuff, right? He's proof that he's heard from God. And he delivers this message to you, right? You would imagine like that we would imagine the next verse is going to say, and the Israelites like rise up and they overthrew Pharaoh. Do you know what I mean? Or the Israelites rejoiced and they celebrated and they thanked God for sending them this message and that hope had entered into their lives. And before, when we preached on this, we preached on these four cups things. We did a whole series, you can find them on the website. And we stopped at this verse 8. We didn't go on to verse 9. I don't know why we didn't at the time, right? But look what their actual response was. Even though God was offering to fulfill the deepest needs of their hearts, you can be a free people. You can be redeemed. You can be set on purpose again. I'm going to be your people. You're going to be my God. You're going to be unique in the world. Yeah, I'm going to give you a land that you promised, fulfilling the deepest, promising the deepest things that their hearts would desire. And in verse 9, Mal, if you put up the next slide, it says Exodus 6 as well. You see it at the end. It says, Moses spoke thus to the people of Israel, but they did not listen to Moses. Why? Because of their broken spirit and their harsh slavery. The tragedy of it. It's not they didn't listen because they were hard-hearted, or they didn't listen because they were sinful, or they didn't listen because they didn't have faith and believe in God could do what God said he would, or all of the things that we might look at people and be like, ah, no, I would be different. You know what I mean? I believe God for his promises. No, they didn't listen to Moses because of their broken spirit and their harsh slavery. Is that not just tragic? That hit me like a ton of bricks, that God revealed himself miraculously, prophetically, burning bushes and all this sort of stuff, speaks and makes these deep promises about what he's going to do for people. But because their spirits had been broken by the world, they weren't able to hear it for what it was. Because their harsh slavery had created conditions where they can't hear the promises of God, where they're numb to it. Overwork, guys, as a tool of the enemy, numbs you to hearing the voice of God. It'll wear you out and burn you out and try to stop you from reaching out to the one who can get you out of the situation. It numbs us. Open any page of the New Testament, right? Like just any page. Pick one at random. Guarantee you there's life-changing promises in there. Life-changing. But are we numb to them? Because of the 9-to-5 grind, because of the pressures of family, because of the pressures of this world, the pressures of trying to carve out identity for ourselves, achieve all of that stuff. We're just on the treadmill and we miss out what God is consistently saying, what he's revealed to us, the promises he has for us. Those promises are yours, by the way. There's this beautiful thing where Jesus at the Passover, I told you the Jews like had this Passover feast, they take there's four cups as part of the Passover meal, right? And Jesus takes one of those cups and he's like, do you know what this is my blood poured out for you, the new covenant. See, all of those promises that were made, they're yours because of me, because of what I'm going to do on the cross, right? Oh, that you're going to be my people, that I'm going to free you, that I'm going to deliver you, I'm going to redeem you, that I'm going to walk with you. Like, all of those things are ours in Jesus, right? But how many of us miss them in just in the 9-to-5 grind? Not even the 9-to-5 grind, the 24/7 grind. Or even if it's not in work, in just the constant scrolling on social media or whatever it is, you know the things that dominate your heart. the worries, the fears, the anxieties, the trying to get over sin, trying to rebuild your life after hard times, trying to make a way for yourself, trying to get enough money to prove yourself. We live in this constant balance of, I need more rest, but I also need to work so that I can afford to rest, right? Or I just need more rest and I don't want to abandon work, but you find that still doesn't satisfy your soul. That's the condition where we're enslaved, I believe. And in the middle of that, God wants to do something. Just as a little aside, can I also say, that's the reason why there's work like the work in Lesotho. That's the reason why there's work like the Liberty Soup Run, or like the things that we do to reach out to those who are broken, the things that we do to refer people to addiction services to help. Because people are blinded by their harsh slavery and their forced labor, their broken spirit. God needs to get the people out of Egypt before they can actually listen to him and know who he is. He needs to do these acts of deliverance. And via us, God, via his church, that's what he wants to do to people and for people. He wants to show them there's a way beyond. You meet people's needs. We reach out in love. We reflect the heart of God to people so that people's eyes are open. It's very hard. It's very hard to tell somebody, yeah, trust in God when they're starving. Or, like, and of course it's the answer, but you'll be blinded to it. Alright, it's okay for you to say trust in God. You have too much food in your fridge. Do you know what I mean? Like, but you need to meet those needs. That's what God calls us to do. Jesus came to proclaim good news to the captives, good news to the poor, freedom for recovery of sight for the blind, freedom for the captives. There's a practical outworking where God delivers so that our eyes are open to be able to see who he is. And in the middle of it, we as a church are meant to act, living as a counterculture example of what it looks like to not be slaves to this world, to not be slaves to the patterns of it, to not be slaves to the pressures of it, to the idols of our own heart, but to live counterculturally so people can look and see there's a group of people who are freed from that. They're not just constantly under pressure to perform. They're not just constantly under the tongue. They're not just constantly striving to prove themselves. There's a group of people who've been freed from that. That's what we have, is freedom. And we have it via this thing called Sabbath, right? Which, I don't know, maybe it sounds a bit religious to you. Maybe we kind of disregard it as some Old Testament practice. Or maybe we just belittle it to be like, well, I understand what Sabbath is. It's just one day off in seven. But there's a deep and profound thing. As you read through Exodus, you see God establishing the Sabbath. But he's establishing it in response, one, to who he is, when you look back to Genesis and how he created. But two, he's establishing it in response to the condition of the people who were overworked and kept enslaved. And he establishes this thing of Sabbath, saying, I'm not like the gods of Egypt. I'm not like the kings of Egypt. I'm going to command that you have rest. I'm going to command that there's a pattern in your life where you remember who I am. You remember who you are. That you're not defined by your work. That you're not defined by your performance. I'm going to command that there's this regular rhythm and space that reminds you that I'm not here to oppress you. I'm not here to enslave you. I'm here to deliver you. And I'm here to set you free. That's who our God is. We see it in Exodus 16. The first time it's mentioned, the Israelites are taken out of Egypt, and now they have no food, and they start giving out to Moses, did you take us out of here just to die? And God says, here's what's going to happen. Some frost is going to come up on the ground every morning, like frost, and it's going to turn into flakes that you can eat. And miraculously, this happens in the desert. They called it manna, which in Hebrew, manna just means that thing. They didn't know what it was, it was just that thing. What is that? It's that thing that comes up on the ground every day. And they take it, and it only lasts 24 hours, right? And God is saying to them, just trust me. Trust me that day after day you're going to have what you need. If you try and store too much of it, it's not going to last beyond the 24 hours. It's going to rot. He's basically saying, you can't use this to leverage and make money for yourself. You can't use this so that the wealthy or the powerful or the group amongst you who are able to take the most, and the people who can't take enough, like, end up down the bottom of the pile, the people with the most, and they turn into their own kind of manna empire, which is what the tendency of humanity would be. Yeah, I'll stockpile this and then I'll sell it, or I'll make money off it. It's like, no, it's going to rot. And so it rots every day, except, and here's the miraculous thing, except on the sixth day when they gather it, and then miraculously the same stuff that rotted in 24 hours now lasts 48 hours, right? And he says, on the sixth day, gather twice as much, and it's going to last you through the seventh day. It's God teaching this lesson of, I'm going to do something miraculous that enables you to take a day off, right? And more than a day off, that says something deeper about the nature of life, what it means, the rhythms that we should have in remembering who God is, looking to him for provision, remembering what he's done. He's like, I'm going to establish this in a miraculous way. That's the first time Sabbath is mentioned. And he says this in Exodus 16. He says, I'm going to give you the gift of the Sabbath. Like, the Sabbath is a gift from God. It's a gift of freedom in the midst of a world that doesn't look to give you any gifts. It looks to say you earn everything that you have. It's a picture of grace right in the beginning of Exodus. I'm going to give you. Like, just look to me to provide. Trust me to provide. And then, by Exodus 20, which is the last scripture we'll look at, we see God, Moses is up on Mount Sinai, and God begins to explain to Moses, hey, here's how I want you guys to live as my people, right? And he gives him the Ten Commandments. And in the middle of the Ten, we have this, I think it's the fourth commandment, and he says this, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you, your son, your daughter, your male servant, your female servant, or your livestock, the sojourner who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, and the sea and all that's in them, and rested on the seventh. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Do you know what? So this is in the Ten Commandments. I don't know, we could probably list them off if I asked you. You might remember them when you learned them in primary school or something. But if you or I were to make up Ten Commandments, you probably wouldn't put one about Sabbath in there. Like, you get the do not murder, honor your parents, relationship, you get the stuff for worshiping the Lord, don't make idols. But why, like, the top ten, first, like, revelation, here's the commands. There's this thing about taking the day off. It doesn't seem that important, right? But obviously, from the context we can elicit that it absolutely is important. And I think we need to hear as well, guys, that it's a command. We see little of it, I think, at times, to our detriment. See, it's more than just a day off when you need it. It's a command rooted in the nature of God. He pulls back to, like, here's what I am, because this is who I am, right? This is the way that I created the world. This is the order that I created it in. And it's God saying that you're not going to be slaves under my rule. I'm commanding you to rest. Some people will say, well, I don't obey the Sabbath thing because that was Old Testament. But I don't know, to me, that's the same as saying, well, I murder people sometimes because that was Old Testament. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just like, that's there. Or I can commit adultery sometimes. That was Old Testament. It doesn't matter if I do that. You know, I don't have to honor my parents. I worship idols sometimes. That was Old Testament. It's in these commands, this pattern. Now, not that it becomes a ritual, not that it becomes religious, not that it becomes a way that we say we earn anything, like, or those kind of things that we tend to do with the commands of God, use them for self-righteousness. Instead, we need to see that it's a gift. This is God, in his laying out what it's to look like to follow him, saying, I'm not like this world. I see the oppression of this world. I see how it uses work to enslave you. That's not me. I'm commanding you to rest. I'm commanding you to have a regular practice where you have no work. And it's more than a practical thing. It's a spiritual thing. It's a God-ordained thing. It's not just God saying, have some balance in life. I think it's important that you have a day off in seven so that you can rest. It's not just saying, look after yourself, don't work too hard. It's about relationship with him, and it's only possible because of him. I'm going to look at Jesus. We're going to finish with communion, but the world will have you look at things in one of two ways, right? I think, in general terms, right? When it comes to work and rest. One, it'll say that work is what it's all about. It'll say to you, whether it says it out loud or not, but you might be able to trace it to the way that you think or you act. Says that you're defined by your doing. That work hard, that achievement defines you. The position you get or the money you get in the bank or whatever it is, that achievement, having the degree under your belt, the title, the sense of having achieved something, that defines you. And that will say to you now, you can't rest, right? Because you need to keep up with that, right? You need to keep defining yourself. You need to keep working until, like, and it's a never-ending thing. It's diminishing returns. Or if it does tell you to rest, it'll say this. It'll say, rest in so much that allows you to do better at the thing that you're really meant to do, right? It'll say functional rest, right? So the reason why you should rest is so that you're better at work. Right? But really what that's just doing is feeding the idols of our hearts, feeding those idols of needing people's approval, of needing significance, of needing security that maybe comes from money or position or power. It's feeding those things, and we can try and use rest as a way, we can think we're resting, but really what we're trying to do is just make ourselves better at that thing that looks to enslave us. The second way, right, so one says, like, work is good, rest is good, in so much as it helps you to work. The second way is, like, just like hedonism is just saying, well, no, life doesn't exist to be enjoyed. So only work as much as you need to work to be able to rest, right? So it doesn't work to get enough money, or you're lucky enough to be independently wealthy. Don't worry about work. Just like, just rest. Just enjoy it. Just get the most out of it. Don't take on any pressures. Don't take on. It's just about how you exist in life. Flow on through. Get the most pleasure you can out of every day. All of it is meaningless anyway. Just enjoy it as much as you can. Rest is good, and work is good only in as much as it enables rest. Now, the gospel, as we should be used to by now, offers a third way, which isn't the extremes of either one, which we can fall into. It tells us that both work and rest are good and ordained by God, that says He created you for good works in advance that you would walk in them, yeah? And it tells us that work and rest go hand in hand as ways that we relate to God and ways that we live out our purpose in the world, that we find God in both because He does both. So for the Christian, our hope isn't in work giving our life meaning. And for the Christian, our hope isn't in rest giving our life meaning. Our hope is in Jesus, who accomplished for us in His work on the cross more than we could ever hope to, and who offers us a rest deeper than just the absence of work. See, every bit of work that we do, guys, is really a striving for something deeper. You've heard me talk about it before. Tim Keller talks about the work under the work, right? That's why you can rest from your work and physically take a day off, go away on a holiday. But that internal condition of the striving, the need to prove, the need to be secure, the need, those deep-seated needs that exist in you rightly as a human, the need to be seen, the need to achieve, the need to have purpose, all of those things will take work, or the enemy will sell us in some way. Work is the way to achieve that, right? Your job, or what you achieve, what people see you doing, is the way to achieve that. And it's counterfeit. Because what Jesus really offers us, the significance, the acceptance, the love, the identity that He really offers us through the cross, is so much more than what we could ever hope to achieve through our work. And He does it as a gift to us. That's what the cross says. On the cross, Jesus says, it is finished. Meaning His work was finished. Meaning also our work was finished. The work under the work. And when we're freed, then work can take on the role that it's supposed to be. Work can be worship. Work can be celebratory. Work can be like a good thing. But I want to say to you like that. This Sabbath practice is only possible because of Jesus. It's possible because Jesus actually satisfies the deeper things that we're really working for. And it's possible because the story of Jesus and His resurrection from the dead and His ascension into heaven, His intercession for the saints, the promise of His return, tells us that the world is changing, that what God is recreating the world into the understanding it's meant to be in. That if we participate in that kingdom, we're not on the losing side. Drill that down to the practicalities of it. You might say, well, look, that's well and good for you to say, Robin. The environment I work in makes these demands on me. What I'm telling you is that if you're obedient to the demands of God rather than to the demands of this world, you'll be proved to be God. And we can only do that in as much as we're secure in the demands of the kingdom of God, in the coming of the kingdom of God. Otherwise, we'll be pressured into just the systems of this world. To not be conformed to the patterns of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. There's a kingdom that's coming that operates differently, that doesn't see you as a commodity to make money for a company. It doesn't see you as a commodity to be used to further somebody else's agenda. But that sees you as unique and created in the image of God for a purpose. Made to live in community. Made to live in eternity. Made to reflect the heart of God. Made to have subdue and have rule over creation. Made to live forever free from that stuff. We get to operate in that now. Sabbath, guys. Practicing Sabbath, I'm convinced, is the way into that. It's the access point into that. Sabbath is the practice that'll keep you free. You might say, well, how can that do that, Rob? Like just taking a day off a week. I'm telling you. The practice of it, the rhythm of it, there's too much for me to go into how it does it, right? Because we'd be here all day, all week, all month. But it does. It's one of the practices we're committed to, like the practice of prayer, like the practice of reading the Bible. It's like it's of being in community. It's one of those things that iteratively, week after week, rhythm after rhythm, like month after month, year after year, transforms us into the image of God. It's having a space in your life every week that you remember who God is and who you are. The difference when you try to take on the space, when you remember your identity, Do you know, guys, it's only when you try and when you step off the treadmill intentionally and you decide I'm not working for this time, you realize that man, I haven't done this in years. I haven't rested from the work. There hasn't been I remember when we first started to practice the Sabbath, I realized there hadn't been a space in years where my head had stopped. I've had times I've worked, had days off, days ago, whatever, like hiking, or days like holidays away from staying or whatever, but the head is gone. Yeah? But they need to prove, they need to achieve, they need to have meaning in life, so it's always spinning, it's always gone. As you step off in a regular rhythm, if we began to practice it week after week, you realize those things, you're like, man, I'm not even sure, who do I think I am? What's just the perspective that comes of who God is. You are, as you begin to look back like God does, like when the rhythm of creation, and everything he does, and then it's like, and he saw that it was good. Looking back with gratitude on what you've done in the week, and what you've done in the day, what God has done, seeing his work and being grateful for it, just takes you from this striving space into a space of freedom. It'll free you. Like having a weekly rhythm of saying, like, Lord, you promised me that your yoke is easy and your burden is light. I don't feel like I'm carrying an easy yoke or a light burden, so that means I must be carrying something that isn't from you. Will you take it? Weekly. Imagine if your life didn't look like that, just ongoing and living under those pressures. But the longest it would last, that is like 6 days before there's a Sabbath again. And it's like, Lord, take that, release. When you stop working and you realize how much you're probably just defined by your work, you realize how much it means to you when you try and stop and you're, oh, I need to do that, I need to do this thing, but just this draw to it, this compulsion to your phone, to your email, to the things that look, I don't know, just regularly having a day where there's a discipline of saying no, not today. Just let you see those things in light of what they really are. It brings clarity, it brings perspective. It's a declaration, and Sabbath is a declaration that you're not a slave. It's like a cry of freedom, saying, no, I'm not a slave to my work, I'm not a slave to my boss, I'm not a slave to the economy, I'm not a slave to the systems of this world, I'm not a slave to my own ambition, I'm not a slave to my own fear of not having enough, I'm not a slave to people's opinions, I'm not a slave to any of the things that tell me that you can't get off the treadmill, Rob, you need to keep going. It's a declaration of trust that God is God. And I just believe it'll change your identity. It's an act of worship, an act of remembering who God is. Those people who couldn't hear the voice of God because of their harsh labor and their broken spirit, what if once a week God had established a rhythm where they got to remember you're not a slave, where they could bring their brokenness to God and say, man, I've accumulated this over the week, will you take it, will you heal me? That God would rid you of your burdens. And you grow in it as you practice it, right? All of this sermon really comes to this point of just saying, please, church, please, will you begin to practice a Sabbath? You're going to have to organize your life to do that. There's going to be patterns. When we started that practice, I used to be writing sermons on a Saturday, and we just had to pull it back and say, no, it happens on a Friday. My Sabbath is Friday, it's Saturday, because this is work for me, believe it or not. Sunday morning, so I do like Friday into Saturday. Look, there's a regular rhythm. Switch off the phone, gather around a meal, say to the Lord, we enter your rest. Simple, but profound. Change your life in multitude of ways, in multiple ways that you'll experience as you do it. But the thing is, are we going to do it? What's going to shout against that? What's going to shout against that is the systems of the world, is the enemy, is your own drives, is all of that sort of stuff. But it's a chance to silence it then. It's a chance week after week to grow in the grace of God that he's given to us. God will provide for you, guys, as you take a day off, like he provided the manna that lasted for 2 days. That's who he is. He's trying to teach us those things. Dependence on him. Switch off from the work.